Welcome to this episode of Accounting Stories. In this episode, my co-hosts, Christian Peters, and myself talk with Catherine Caduce. Catherine is the Schaefer Shared Professor of Accounting and the Associate Dean of the PhD program at Emory University's Goizueta Business School. Catherine's research focuses on judgment and decision-making issues in auditing and accounting and uses psychology theory. She has published in the very top accounting journals as well as in psychology journals. She has held several positions with the American Accounting Association and just started as the senior editor of the Accounting Review, which is the flagship journal of the American Accounting Association. We will talk with Catherine about some pressing problems in the auditing sector, her research, and some important challenges in accounting research. Of course, we will blend this with some of her personal stories. Enjoy this new episode of Accounting Stories. Catherine, welcome to our podcast. You're here in Tilburg, amongst others, to teach the PhD students in the Limper course on experimental accounting research. So, what do you want students or those students to remember from your course?
Thanks, Bart. I'm happy to be here. Three things is not a lot, but I think I want them to see the beauty of JDM experimental research and know what it can and can't do. Mm-hmm. And I want to give them some ideas about how to do it better if they choose to do it. So
that's two already?
That's two. And then I guess the third one is more for me than them. I love getting the energy of the young scholars. So mm-hmm. I want to benefit from their energy, but also have them share that with each other.
So the beauty of JDM, can you explain that in a nutshell?
In a nutshell, no, I probably can't. But I think the beauty is... that you can run an experiment using scenarios and people will behave as they do in their natural situation. So I think experiments get a lot of flack from people who don't do them mm-hmm. for not being not being realistic mm-hmm. and, you know, oh, you're just telling them a story, giving them a scenario. But it's really easy to put professionals especially into a setting that they've been in 100 times before, and they will bring all of how that setting makes them feel and makes them behave with them. So experiments can be, even a, you know, 20, 30 minute experiment can be a really efficient way to learn about something as complex as auditor judgment. Mm-hmm.
So that's maybe already the number one question that is on the top of the mind of many of our listeners. How do you respond if you present a paper and you get like a comment like this is, but this is not how it is in the real auditing world, or this is very artificial? What are your tactics?
It depends on the specific situation, but that is the very delicate balance of auditing JDM research or JDM research applied to any field. We really have to figure out what needs to be realistic. Mm-hmm. Right, and what doesn't need to be realistic. Yeah. And in my mind, if you can put people in that setting, sometimes very easily by saying, you know, your client has these features, your boss has these preferences, that sort of thing, and then retain the structure, the important structural features of the task you're asking them to do, mm-hmm. then everything else doesn't necessarily need to be realistic. Yeah. So you can give them a manipulation that is straight out of psychology, right? Sometimes, depending on what it is. And it doesn't have to look like something that would happen in the auditing world in order to inform how a manipulation or how that construct influences judgment in the accounting world.
And because you referred to psychology, I think that's pretty interesting. You also have published there. Is that maybe the big difference with like JDM psychology research, that in auditing you need to think more carefully about what needs to be realistic, while in JDM psychology research you can do like nearly everything and create a more that efficient, like at least
yes.
That's...
Can people hear me nodding?
Yes.
I mean, that's definitely one big difference is, we, as applied researchers, we need to make sure that we provide a contribution back to our field. So if we're going to publish in accounting journals, we should be very careful about making sure we're learning about an accounting phenomenon or an accounting decision. Another difference that I think is pretty important is that studying in applied context gives us access to much more complex, interesting problems than I think we would think of if we were just doing anything, right? Yeah. So sometimes the problems seem more constrained because they're specific, but they're also, you know, I mean, the science of complex judgments didn't get very far in psychology because you need a complex judgment to study.
Okay.
And there's not like a complex judgment that requires expertise, that requires specific knowledge of various types that you can give to, you know, just anybody and test in a large sample.
Yeah.
So I think it's easier, in fact, to do that sort of thing in accounting.
No, so we need to think about what needs to be realistic and what doesn't need to be realistic. I think that's a very good piece of advice. So, you know, you have worked with many PhD students over, throughout your career. You're also the PhD director at Goizueta. So how do current PhD students, the ones that you teach, let's say, as of tomorrow, how do they differ from those, let's say, like the first one you supervised? And
do you
have to supervise them differently?
They seem younger now, but that might not be them. I think PhD programs have changed a lot, at least in the U.S. over the time period that I've been doing this thing. We used to have students take several years of courses. Mm-hmm. And so they had a lot of time to, you know, maybe if you took 4 years of courses throughout the university, you had a lot of time to, as a student, to read a lot of papers and think about problems before you felt pressure to engage in your own research. And now PhD programs have shortened over the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. and in most places I'm aware of, the students are very anxious to get to doing their own research, in part reasonably because that's what they came here to do or came to the program to do, but in part because of additional pressure in the job market. Yeah. So they know they need a publication or two or at least
or more.
papers under review in order to get a good job. So the job market's a lot more fierce. The time schedule is compressed. And honestly, it makes it harder to supervise the students regardless of who they are. So some challenges that I see are getting them to slow down and do all the background reading that they need to do mm-hmm. in order to really do high quality work and be aware of what came before them.
Yeah. So, you know, my co-host today is Christian Peters. He's about to graduate. So he will start as an assistant professor. And we have like many listeners who are also in either the PhD. Christian, welcome, by the way.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
It's really nice that you are willing to do this at the day that you, hopefully will graduate. We still do not yet know for 100%.
TBD.
If you're sitting here with auditors, we need to be careful in what we saying. So, so what would be for people like Christian, like PhD students, assistant professors, what would be your number one advice to, for having a successful career, whatever success means, based on your own experience, based on what you see?
Number one, I think two things are really important. I have a hard time choosing one. I think for one, do everything the best you can do it. I think that's really the secret to success in the long run. I think students and new faculty feel a lot of pressure, again, to publish. And so they want to be strategic and, you know, think about what is publishable. I think that's important, but that should not be the first consideration. Mm-hmm. That should be the first consideration should be, what am I interested in? Because if I'm really interested in it, I'm going to do it really well. I also have a piece of advice that I did not take, and most people my age, my era, did not take, which is figure out what success means to you, right? So it might not mean publishing, you know, 100 papers. It might mean something else. So figure out what success means to you so that you can, you know, aim at the right target.
Yeah. Christian, have you heard it?
Yeah, very, very good advice. Thank you very much.
I would also say try to do something nice next to only working, next to just teaching and research, because you see many assistant professors, PhD students at the end of their PhD or tenure track that hopefully ends in a successful way, that, you know, they have all type of illnesses and diseases. And I think that's also not what we, how we like want to picture our profession. So
yeah, I think that's right. I've been surprised by that over the years. You see, you know, typically like weight gain and all these things during that first 7-8 years. And then 2 years after tenure, you see someone again at a conference and they look
Better.
But you can't really put off life, right, during those important years.
That's indeed true.
Yes, in this podcast, we also talk about pressing problems in the auditing sector. One of the current pressing problems is the shortage of auditors, not only in the Netherlands, but also in the United States. And the auditing firms often blame the regulators for having a too tough stance. And the regulators often blame the auditing firms for not paying enough. Well, the Wall Street Journal recently found that more than 300,000 US accountants and auditors left their jobs in the past 2 years. What do you think that what factors cause this turnover? And what can audit firms do to retain these professionals?
Yeah,
so
you
are
question.
Asked to solve the problem.
Yeah,
now.
I was going to say, I'm not...
For free.
Right. I'm not necessarily an expert on any of these things, but I do study auditor engagement with their job. And so I can say the younger auditors that I have interviewed in this project recently, they do talk about how many hours they work, and not in a favorable way. and they talk about their pay not in a favorable way. I mean, I don't know how it is in the Netherlands, but in the U.S., accounting used to be, you know, say 15 years ago, the best paid major in the business school, and now it's the worst in terms of, you know, our graduating students right out the door. So I think there are some things to fix there. But there are also additional factors, like there are also...
Maybe we need to stop it here like a little bit. Like if you are like a big foreign accountancy firm and let's say 15 years ago, you were paying the best wages compared to people in finance, operations, marketing. And 15 years later, you are not the best paying employer anymore. Then there is something that you didn't do very well or that you didn't pay attention to.
And they are still very profitable. So that's not the issue.
Yeah, so that's not the issue. Yeah. Did they lose sight of that these are important things to manage, or that it's like that auditing is also like managing a firm? Managing people?
I don't manage a firm, so I don't know, but that certainly seems possible. I think, you know, feeding into this, one of the reasons that a lot of auditors left their jobs was probably that also that they could, because it is a great job to have on your in your background, on your CV. And I think firms kind of overvalue that, right? They think that students are long-term maximizers, but we all know that they're not, right? I mean, maybe some of them are, but it's hard to overlook, you know, it's hard to accept a job for, say, $30,000 less a year with the idea that in 5 or 10 years, I might be a little better off. So I think they did lose sight of that. I think the model, you know, there's also a lot of uncertainty about what will happen to auditing as technology continues to take off. So I think there have been stories that, you know, auditing is one, or accounting in general, is one of the areas where AI can replace a lot of a lot of workers. So that's probably not attracting people to the field either.
Yeah, and that's like brings like the second related question here is that's up or out system, and I think Christian also already like referred to it. It's a system that works as long as you have like a steady inflow of students from a major in accountancy. At least what we see here in the Netherlands is that that inflow is drying up. So the next question then is, how could we make like the master in accountancy more popular among students? How could we create more inflow there? How could we make accounting popular among like 18, 19, 20 years old? Why this is... this is the major that you have to do.
I know in the U.S. the accounting programs are very regimented. I assume that here as well, there are lots of very specific courses you have to take in order to get certified, lots of technical courses. That might not be that attractive to students. I don't know if that could change, but I do know firms are hiring outside of accounting majors, so that tells me they don't necessarily believe they need everyone to know all those things when they come in. I think a big thing is, I mentioned earlier, like how engaged are auditors with their job? How much do they enjoy their job? I think in this time when there's a lot of uncertainty about what may happen in the future, and we hear firms saying that you know, AI will take over all the mundane parts of the job and you'll only get to do the fun ones, but I don't think that's auditors' current experience. I think there's a bit of a disconnect there. So I think what firms can do is maybe take a look at some of the research that's been done and figure out how to make their auditors enjoy their work, be proud of their work, mm-hmm. because it is, you know, critical to how the capital markets function, and, you know, really kind of dig in and do a great job with it, which then starts this virtuous cycle, because then you enjoy your work more when you're better at it and it's more important.
I think this is it's grounded in research, and I think that's definitely nice. And what I think is important is that people just want to enjoy their work, you know, they don't want to do all the after party. You know, working at the big four is not nice because, you know, you on Friday evenings you have this, you know, a lot of people want to enjoy the work because of the work and not because of all the surrounding things. Christian, I maybe have a question for you. So you decided to do the master in accountancy with the idea, I'm going to work at a big four.
Yeah.
And then, you know, my story, you know, you have a car and you drive from one farm in Noord-Brabant to another farm to do inventory counting. At some point you decided, you know, and you also worked a little bit at a big four audit firm, but then you decided to do the research master. In the research master, you did quite some interviews and a PhD program. You talked a lot with auditors, with young auditors, even auditors that were younger than you. So what do you see, what have you seen the last 5 years, how young auditors, how their view on their job is changed, and then especially in the Netherlands?
Yeah, I think from the interviews I did and when I worked there, I saw that like the traditional partner model, like which basically is life is not that nice. You work very high workload and then you become partner and you earn a lot. And that's like the pyramid structure.
After 15 years.
yes. So I think that model is maybe not that proof for the future. I think the current generation is not only interested in working and earning money, but are looking more for a work-life balance. And that may be one of the reasons also why auditors leave in the first 3 years of their career or once they get their charter. Mm-hmm. So I've seen this shift in how people look at their job and the role of their job in their life. And I think that's something audit firms really need to consider in the future when hiring or retaining auditors.
But that's like, you know, it's important, but what could, let's say, an audit firm do to balance that work life? Because we all know there are busy seasons. So is it possible? Is it easy to change? Obviously not, otherwise they would have done it. But
yeah, I think audit firms are already doing a lot. But maybe one anecdote from one of my friends that I talk to a lot. I won't say who it is and I won't say the firm, but he basically worked
we can cut it if you want.
70 or 80 hours a week and was asked by the partner to do so. Then a week after, he was approached by the same partner who was also the people's partner of the auditing firm. And he was, the partner told him, like, you work too much. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't work this much because it's against the regulations and we will get a fine if you work too much. So it was the same partner that told him to work longer and then in another role told him to not work longer.
Yeah.
So I think audit firms should take a clear stance on this workload, on these aspects of the job, and yeah, make clear to auditors and to potential auditing students what they expect from them and what they offer.
Yeah, I hear a lot of research questions here. So we have work for the future.
One of the other pressing issues in the auditing profession is the recurring deficiencies in audits that are being found, sometimes audit failures. And reports by auditing regulators show that they often relate to a lack of professional skepticism. And in the past decade, you've done a lot of work researching professional skepticism. And you find that it seems to come from normal human judgment tendencies. Can you maybe delve deeper into these judgment tendencies that lead to a lack of professional skepticism, and maybe also in the interventions that audit firms can use to alleviate these lack of professional skepticism?
Sure. Yes, this is an area where my own thinking has evolved over the years as I've done research. So I will admit to early on kind of believing that, oh, auditors just do what their clients say because, you know, their clients pay them or whatever it may be. And in applying JDM theory and, you know, over the years, I realized that the situation is much more nuanced and much more complex than that, that even very well-intentioned auditors who care about getting things right are subject to human tendencies such as, you know, it's much easier to take a model, say, that a client gives you for a complex estimate and break it down in pieces and confirm each part of it, you know, look for, is there a way that I can make that revenue number work? Is there a way I can make that? That even sounds too intentional, but like, do I see that revenue number? Is there support for that? Is there support for this other number? Is there support for the discount rate, et cetera? And when you make judgments like that, you do not consider, it's hard to consider the interconnections among the pieces of the puzzle. And so when the regulators say lack of professional skepticism, what they're typically seeing is, you know, there are inconsistencies in valuations, for instance, even within a model or across how two different valuations are done across two models, and the auditor didn't catch them. Well, what we learned from JDM is that this is a natural result of being, you know, what we used to call a cognitive miser, right? That's probably a term we should revive. It's you can't be on at 100% all the time, working hard, thinking about everything, holding multiple pieces of information in your head, thinking about their interconnections, thinking deeply about how they impact other things all the time, especially if you are under time pressure, budget deadlines, that sort of thing. So it's natural to default to simplify, right? To do what seems like a reasonably straightforward approach to the problem, but that approach is often inadequate. So that approach works well for a lot of what auditors might do or used to do. For instance, 100 years ago when I was an auditor, we, you know, looked at fixed asset value. You know, we looked at invoices to make sure the historical costs of the fixed assets was right. You can do those one at a time because there's a number and you really literally need to confirm it and they're all separate. When you talk about the complex estimates that are in financial statements today, that doesn't work. But it's probably reasonable and certainly natural for auditors like other people to follow that process. So what can we do about this? This to me is interesting because I started several different projects thinking all the interventions were very different. And then when I look back, as you said, over the last 10 years or so of my research, I see that mainly these interventions have to do with changing two things. One, invoking processes that are more complex, or by changing mindset, for instance, or two, getting auditors more interested in, engaged in the task so that they will naturally do that deeper digging and naturally make those connections.
What I really like in your answer, and again, that I think for me, that's the beauty of research. Basically, you said, like, in the beginning, I thought the reason for a lack of professional skepticism or low audit quality was because auditors feel pressured by clients. And because of that, they made some judgments that were not fully correct. And then you say, like, I learned that that is maybe not the main reason, but that it's more like human tendencies. Mm-hmm. I think as a researcher, that is a you know, that is a great thing that we can change our mind. And I would like to understand that a little bit more, just in general, not only like how that's changed for you, but was that a light bulb moment or did that come like slowly? and that you thought like, well, and do you still remember like when you started changing your thinking? Because that, you know, we have those examples where people come up with something in the beginning of their career and they stick to that until the end of times.
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't think that's what good research should be. So can you give us a little bit of insight on into how that process happened for you?
I think first let me tell you a little story. When I was a doctoral student, I had the privilege of going to the University of Illinois and sitting in on, well, taking all kinds of PhD seminars in psychology from like really world-class people. And a very famous memory categorization person came in the classroom one day and he's like, that paper I had you read, it's all wrong. Here's how I think it works now. And to me, that was just such great inspiration. And I will say that I don't like to be wrong, but he gave a a really great example of how being wrong is how you move forward, or at least knowing that, understanding that you were wrong is how you move forward. For me, it didn't happen all at once. I think, you know, I worked on what I found interesting, and gradually I think the interventions to correct these kinds of judgment problems kind of evolved. I would do more reading and more reading. And then it was, I mean, I had an inkling, but it wasn't like a light bulb. But I think what was really helpful to me was to work on a framework paper where I really had to think about this. And to work on that with, you know, great co-authors who we could bounce stuff off of, who were also in the, you know, in the earlier literature where we thought the problem was something other than what we now think it is. Mm-hmm. So it's for me like continuing to push the edges until you realize that you're in a different. You're on a different plane now, I think, is how it happened.
Yeah. I think that's really nice to hear. Thanks a lot for sharing like that also those nice anecdotes that it's, you know, as long as we understand why we are wrong as a researcher, that's not too big of a problem.
Move science forward in the future, it is important that behavioral auditing research is conducted with auditor participants, especially experiments and surveys. A current problem is that there's in many countries a lack of auditor participants. Audit firms are not always that willing to participate with researchers. What paths forward do you see, and what opportunities are there for academics and audit practitioners to collaborate with each other?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a big issue. It's a big problem in the U.S. Right now. Probably worldwide. The pandemic really interfered with in-person data collection, and we get the best data. We can run the best experiments when we can do them in like a training classroom, because then we get kind of the whole population, or at least the whole population of that class, rather than the individuals who self-select into doing a study that was emailed to them. It's also, we also then get the data collected under similar conditions at the same point in time. So there's less chance that extraneous variables will influence the answer. So they're not going to be, we'll have higher quality data that way for sure. And that completely stopped in the U.S. And has yet to really resume. So I personally try to work on firms and press upon them the importance of participating with this research. I think in the Netherlands, the FAR is a great resource, and I really appreciate that they value research and want to learn from it. And I find in the U.S., when I talk to individual partners, they often value it and are interested in, you know, send me that intervention. I'll try it out on my, you know, in my office. But the firms at the national level don't have a great mechanism. So we have something through the, it used to be the Center for Audit Quality, and now the American Accounting Association runs it, that provides access, but it's very few. The last few years, it's been very few studies that have been selected. So I would like to see firms just more interested at the national level in learning what they can learn from research. I don't know how to make that happen. If you know, tell me, please.
Yeah, well, we shouldn't ask you to solve all the problems, you know? It's, but maybe one other problem. Okay, one other problem. Like, it's often mentioned that replications are very important for trust in science. Also, being able to publish good research that doesn't accept the hypothesis, but we don't see it that often. Yeah. I have myself a replication, and it's not easy to get it published. Definitely not in the top journals. and you're a senior editor now of one of the top journals, and this can lead to what Christian often calls, like, and other people, maybe a file drawer problem, that like research that is interesting for the community to know, like, okay, this works or this doesn't work, or this is easy to replicate, this is a strong effect, this one not, that remains in the it getting published. Like, are there initiatives that we can do to get more replications published and extensions and these type of things?
Yeah, I think one problem with this is that the literature is very diverse. So we don't have, you know, a small set of really key hypotheses that lend themselves to retesting. Instead, I think we see a lot of replication as part of other studies, right? Mm-hmm. So you might see, you know, say Christian shows some interesting effect, then the next person might come along and show it also happens here, or it happens, but you can fix it with this other manipulation. I guess I say we see that, but ideally we would see that. I think one problem with publishing in a county is we often think if we have one paper on a topic, we know everything about a topic.
Yeah, and it's set in stone.
right. So I don't know of any initiatives, but I do think that's something as reviewers and editors we should be aware of, that, you know, if there was one study that once found a 0.049 p-value on, or worse, right, even 0.08 or something, p-value on an effect, that, yeah, it's not set in stone, that we probably need to study that effect more if it's an important effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And these are mostly the negative side, but there are also a lot of positive sides. So where do you think research has improved in the past years? And what are those positive sides?
So compared to when you were a PhD student in Illinois and now, what became easier? what is better?
That's a tough question. I think there's better understanding that experimental design and the constructs are very important. So I think we see generally, not always, cleaner kind of experiments with higher quality inference. What's better and what's worse? Or just what's better?
The positive
side.
Positive. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
We have to be positive.
Yeah, and I think we've learned a lot about, there's less resistance to bringing in theories from other areas, from psychology and other areas. When I started, if you didn't show an effect that was non-normative and then fix it, you didn't have an interesting study, right? You didn't have a publishable study. But lots of things are interesting, even if you don't know what the, normatively correct answer is, right? Yeah. So it's interesting that various factors in the audit environment influence judgment and how they do so, even if you don't know which side is right.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a paper from the past years that's among your favorite, or one that you specifically would like to highlight that you think is interesting for the audience?
No self-citations here.
Yeah, I think if I base my answer on the paper I talk about the most, it's the Bennett and Hatfield paper. But I think it's now 10 years old, so I'm not sure if that.
That is not a problem. Like okay. the best paper ever. Okay. What is the paper about, and why do you why do you like it so much?
What I like, the paper shows that auditors who are proxy by audit students but are doing a real task where they are given assertions and they have to go collect data or collect evidence to audit that information are less likely to get the evidence when the person playing the controller is older than them, because they're intimidated. And I think that's just fascinating, because prior to that paper, I think we ignored kind of the social interaction aspect of auditing and of judgment and how big an influence that could have on judgment. And in that paper, they also had another condition where they had the controller be older and act in an intimidating way. And that gave like the same results. So you don't have to have someone acting badly towards you to want to avoid them. They just have to be older than you. And I just found that really resonated with my experience as an auditor trying to collect data in the field from cranky older warehouse managers when I was 21 years old. And yet I never would have really thought of it. And another thing I really like about this study is that they actually showed that the youngsters would often check off that they had collected the data that they hadn't. That's how intimidated they were.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. And I really like about this study, it became kind of relevant again during the COVID crisis, when a lot of the audit work went virtual. Mm-hmm. And like when you have to collect evidence at the client by email or by phone, it's different than when you have to collect it face-to-face. And there's also psychology theory, like social presence theory, informing this. And that's something I really liked about this paper. It's also among my favorites.
Good.
So that brings us already to the last part of the podcast, Catherine. So it's the name of the podcast is Accounting Stories. So we also blend it with like personal stories. You already heard anecdotes about you sitting in a PhD class when you were a PhD student, and some other anecdotes. But if you have to name like a song, book, movie, painting, what would that be? What is the motivational story behind that song, book, movie, painting, whatever you want? Mm. What is the last thing you want to share with our listeners?
I forget movies the moment after they end, so it won't be a movie. But I do really like the book The Overstory by Richard Powell, I believe. It's about how trees are connected to each other underground. And I mean, it relies heavily on science from another book whose name I'm not sure, like a nonfiction book about trees. But it tells several complex stories and ties them together in the end in very unexpected ways. And the I guess some overall messages are that we're all related in very complex ways, and that it's hard to make good choices for the future. You know, we can go about our lives making choices that we think make sense in the moment, but we might be injuring, say, the planet. So one thing I like about it is it's beautifully written, but another thing is that it's an effective way of talking about, you know, climate change and the environment and such through a story,
okay,
which I think is more convincing than just telling people what they do or don't want to believe.
Okay. I think that's indeed the more convincing part. Yeah, we will include it in the podcast notes, and then maybe there's like a peek in the in selling this book. I would like to thank you for this podcast. I think we solved a lot of problems. We tried to solve a lot of problems. So let's see what our listeners do with it. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot again.
Thank you.
Also, Christian, thanks a lot.